It's live. Thank you very much. I want to express my thanks to the committee for the C.S. Lewis lecture, for the opportunity to be here. I have to tip my hat to the mocks who unceremoniously eliminated the University of Georgia from the NCAA tournament. It was a sad moment for us, but you certainly deserve plenty of credit. This lecture is a new one for me. It's number 5 in this series on modern science and the Christian faith, but I've never given it before, so we'll see how this goes. I will say, in my defense, you're wondering why you've never given this before, is I was assigned this title by Terry Morrison. Terry, where are you? If anything goes wrong with this lecture, that's the man right there. He said, would you be willing to give the C.S. Lewis lecture, and would you be willing to speak on this topic? And I said yes, and yes. So this is something new for me, and we'll see how it goes. Before we attempt to analyze C.S. Lewis's thoughts about science, I should try to begin by telling you something about how I feel about science. The answer to that is undoubtedly positive. I fell in love with molecular quantum mechanics 32 years ago, and the passion is still there. Since becoming a Christian in 1973, during my fourth year as a professor at Berkeley, I will say, though, that my perspective on science, the passion is the same, but the perspective has changed. And if I were asked to summarize my view today, I would say, actually, just what I said to U.S. News and World Report 6 years ago. You know, usually when you're quoted in the media, it's wrong. But this was right. They got this right. This is about what I told this reporter. So I'll quote myself since I said this. This is actually about what I said. This is from an interesting cover story some 5.5 years ago. I said, the significance and joy in my science comes in those occasional moments of discovering something new and saying to myself, so that's how God did it. My goal is to understand a little corner of God's plan. So that's my view of science. I just say candidly, every month I take a look at my pay stub and ask myself, how can it be that I'm actually being paid to do something I like as much as this? So I'm unapologetic enthusiast about science. I'm also an admirer of C.S. Lewis. I have read the 7 Narnia books to each of my 4 children, so I'm getting to know those books pretty well, and have read most of Lewis's other non-academic writings, that is, the writings that are not specifically about medieval English literature. So I would count C.S. Lewis among my heroes. I wouldn't say it as bad as hero worship. I wouldn't put him at the very top of my list of intellectual giants for the 20th century. That honor would have to go to the man from Baltimore, J. Gresham Machen, longtime Princeton faculty member and later founder of Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. But I do value the writings of C.S. Lewis tremendously and have given away a great many copies of his masterpiece, Mere Christianity. Where will we try to go tonight? Questions might we hope to address? Well, let's try for 3. Number 1, what did C.S. Lewis think about science and scientism? Now, the times I've given here are are by plan. Having never given this lecture before, I really don't know whether we're going to go for 50 minutes or 75. We'll see. We'll see. Question number two, is scientism alive and well in 1997? And question number three, do nearly all scientists believe in scientism? All right. So let's begin with part number one. What did C.S. Lewis think about scientism? Before we do that, I think we'd better define scientism. Let's define scientism first, and let's just I did this in the most obvious way, which was to look it up in the dictionary and copy it. Okay, so this is what the dictionary has to say about scientism. Gives two definitions. The first is uninteresting, and it's not what C.S. Lewis was talking about when he used the term scientism. The second definition is the appropriate one, especially the tail end of it. So definition number two, scientism, the thesis that the methods of the natural sciences should be used in all areas of investigation, including philosophy, the humanities, and the social sciences. Well, that's getting there, but what it says, what the dictionary says after that really gets to what Lewis was talking about in his mention of scientism, namely a belief that only such methods can fruitfully be used in the pursuit of knowledge, and conversely, that everything else, every other means of pursuing intellectual questions is bankrupt. That's what C.S. Lewis is talking about. Now, the term scientism is related to a couple of other terms, logical positivism, which was certainly a popular thing to talk about in the 1920s, and reductionism, which is a popular thing to talk about in the 1990s. And these terms are related. Okay, in fact, one might almost go so far as to say that they are synonymous. But in any case, they're closely related. I'll try to distinguish between these three terms a little bit, but more or less, they're the same thing. Namely, that only science can be used to investigate any question. All right. Now, I do want to say that C.S. Lewis is not the very first person to approach these questions from the point of view of a person in the humanities. In fact, this recent textbook on literature talks about this, and so I'll quote directly from Susan Gallagher and Roger London at this point in what they have to say. They say this, because in recent history, literature has often found itself in opposition to science. To understand modern views about literature, we must recognize the dominance of science in our culture. For several centuries, the sciences have set the standards of truth for Western culture, and their undeniable usefulness in helping us to organize, analyze, and manipulate facts has given them an unprecedented importance in modern society. So Lewis is not the first one to be concerned about science. And let's go back, maybe 100 years before Lewis to John Keats, the great English romantic poet. And he really didn't like science. It was called philosophy when he was writing. He didn't like it, and you can see in his. Let me just give you just a little piece of this poem, Lamia of his. He says why. He says why. Now in this poem, every time the word philosophy appears, I'm going to replace it with science. So this is going to spoil the a certain aspect of the. Of the poem, but it will more effectively convey the point that Keats is making for a contemporary audience. So, Lamia, do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold science? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We knew her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalog of common things. Science will clip an angel's wings, conquer all mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air and gnomed mind, unweave a rainbow. So he thought that science was had the capability of destroying everything of any value in the world. Now, Lewis acknowledged that his life prior to 1930 was influenced by science, and he did this in not a very positive sense in 1955 in his in the autobiography of his early life, which is called Surprised by Joy, when he explains or tries to explain his atheism up to the age of about 30. Lewis says, "You will understand that my atheism was inevitably based on what I believed to be the findings of the sciences, and those findings, not being a scientist, I had to take on trust, in fact, on authority." So some scientists told him that you couldn't be a scientist and believe in God, and Lewis, not being a scientist, thought that must be right. So that's something of influence. Now, let me make an acknowledgement right at the start here. I need to, you know, since Terry Morrison assigned me this topic, you know, I don't know if I've been assigned a topic to lecture on quite like this in a long time, Terry. As Terry assigned me this topic, he said, "Well, great idea, Terry. You know, do you have any idea where to start working on this?" And he said, "Well, let me look around. I'm going to be up at the C.S. Lewis Library near Chicago and see what I can find." And he sent me a message. He said, "Well, I found a couple things." And he found a couple theses. So I tried to order both of these theses from the University of Michigan, University Microfilms, which have theses, copies about everything. And this one I couldn't get. This one, the theme of the harmful effects of science in the works of C.S. Lewis by Faye Ann Crowell, master's thesis, Texas A&M, August 9th. They don't have it at the University of Michigan. And my secretary, being a resourceful soul, just wrote to Texas A&M and said, "Can you loan us a copy of this thesis for a little while?" And so they sent the only copy of the thesis to us. and we copied it and sent it back to them. So I'm not concerned that anyone in this audience has read this thesis. I will say this, that in lecturing in various places around the world, one does discover that it is a small world. And so if this woman is here in the audience tonight, will you please come forward and at least introduce yourself to me, because I very much enjoyed reading your thesis. And I thank Terry for giving it to me. Let me give credit where credit is due and tell you what her conclusions are. And then you can see if mine are somewhat. Let me begin with her. So these are the conclusions of Faye Ann Crowell, 1971. She says this: "C.S. Lewis feared what might be done to all nature, and especially to mankind, if scientific knowledge were to be applied by the power of government without the restraints of traditional values. These fears are presented dramatically in the space novels. To Lewis, the possibility was great that men would not survive as men." So these are her conclusions on this subject. All right. So with that bit of introduction, let's begin. Let's begin. There are some, certainly, who have read the Lewis canon and thought that Lewis was anti-science. And here is one. Here is one. Philip Deasy wrote in 1958, quote, that the total and unrelenting attack on science was for many readers an insuperable stumbling block. So Deasy's view was that C.S. Lewis was utterly and unrelentingly anti-science. This is from his essay, God, Space, and C.S. Lewis. So that is one view of things. Faye Crowell comments on this. She says, many writers have referred to elements in the trilogy, and I do need to say what the trilogy is. The trilogy is the space trilogy. And I'll say a lot more about these three novels. The first two are kind of mini novels or novelettes, and the third one is a longer work. Many writers have referred to elements in the space trilogy which they think show that Lewis was completely opposed to science. For those who knew him personally and or who have made the most detailed studies of his works, and she gives four examples, have insisted that Lewis was, that it was not science which Lewis was attacking, but certain ideas held by people usually not scientists. So we'll try to look at that. Let me quote one of these friends of Lewis. Chad Walsh wrote the first early description of C.S. Lewis's life, called C.S. Lewis, Apostle to the Skeptics. And based on his, based not on anything that we have in writing from Lewis, but based on his personal discussions with Lewis, Chad Walsh made this statement. He says that he had noticed that noticed that the pure sciences seem to have no dehumanizing effect on those who study them, but the closer a science approaches to human affairs, the more it tends to strip its specialists of their humanity. Sociologists and psychologists are in greater peril than chemists and mathematicians. These are not the words of C.S. Lewis. Let me be very careful. This is what purports to be a reconstruction of Lewis's private remarks to Chad Walsh. All right. The Space Trilogy. Okay. The three books of the Space Trilogy are Out of the Silent Planet, which I just finished rereading to my 16-year-old in Australia over the winter. Out of the Silent Planet, 1938. Paralandra, 1943. And That Hideous Strength, 1945. So I'll have a lot to say about these books, because much of what Lewis has to say is expressed through the two novelettes and the third, a pretty full-length novel. The main character in these books is Elwin Ransom. Elwin Ransom is a theist, that is, one who believes in a personal God, a theist who embraces the values of pity, kindness, honesty, respect for individuals, and so on. Professor Weston, the villain in the first two novels, is a scientist who believes there is no absolute truth or value or God. Weston is willing to sacrifice anyone or anything to his goal of perpetuating human life in the universe. In the third novel, the leaders of something called the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, or the NICE. Actually, they're not very nice, just between friends. The NICE exhibit the ruthless disregard for people that Lewis feared would begin to appear in those who rejected Christian values. Now, one thing about Elwin Ransom, I need to tell you, is he is a philologist, okay? The word philology is receding from the vocabulary of Americans. I will say it's alive and well. I've been to Russia four times, and when they take me around their campuses, the campuses, St. Petersburg State University, they say, and this is where the English philology department is, and this is where the Spanish philology department is, and so on and so forth. So the term is popular elsewhere, but it's dying in American English. But this is what it is. This is what Ransom is. Ransom is the hero in the Space Trilogy. He is a philologist. He's at Cambridge or Oxford, some really good place. And philology is the study of literature, but in a particular sense, that includes or may include grammar, criticism, literary history, language history, systems of writing, and anything else that is relevant to literature or to language as used in literature. So philologists, I think nowadays, would appear in a in English departments, although they might end up wherever experts in linguistics reside as well. And those of you who are academics will know that linguists end up in different places. All right. In the second chapter of the first book in the space trilogy, Out of the Silent Planet, a partially drugged Ransom, the philologist, the hero, hears a conversation. He's been kidnapped and he's going to some planet elsewhere. He hears a conversation between his kidnappers, and one of them is a gentleman named Dick Devine. Devine reflects his own selfishness and lack of concern for really anybody else's life. And Professor Weston, the arch-villain — Dick Devine is just a villain, Weston is the arch-villain — and exhibits Weston's lack of compassion as well as his zeal for wrong goals. Weston and Devine had intended to kidnap a mentally retarded young boy, young 16, 17, 18 years old, something like that. But the whole plan had blundered, and they ended up with the philologist instead. Strange interposition. Weston is perfectly willing to sacrifice the mentally retarded boy because he says that he was, quote, incapable of serving humanity and only too likely to propagate idiocy. Continuing the quote from Weston, he was the sort of boy who in a civilized community would be automatically handed over to a state laboratory for experimental purposes. The physicist is not so excited about taking Ransom with him because he is, quote, human, unquote, as opposed to the handicapped boy. But Weston argues that Ransom is, quote, only an individual and probably a quite useless one. Weston earlier had dismissed Ransom's work in philology as, quote, unscientific tomfoolery, which was, quote, wasting money that ought to go to research. So we're getting a bit of the character, I hope, of the principles here. Let me give you just a bit of the actual dialogue, just so this won't be entirely artificial. So I'll give you a bit of an exchange between the villain, physicist, Weston, who says, you cannot — and he's speaking to Ransom, the hero, the philologist — you cannot be so small-minded as to think that the rights or the life of an individual or of a million individuals are of the slightest importance in comparison with this being his great scheme. His great scheme, as described by Ransom, is the off chance that some creatures or other descended from man, as we know him, may crawl about a few centuries longer in some part of the universe. So you can see these two individuals don't really agree on basic worldview. And then back to the villain, Weston, once again, it would be easier if your philosophy, your Ransom philosophy of life, were not so insufferably narrow and individualistic. Even a worm, if it could understand, would rise to the sacrifice. All educated opinion, for I do not call classics and history and such trash education, is entirely on my side. So we do have two conflicting characters. Lewis describes Professor Weston as a man obsessed with the idea, which at this moment is circulating all over our planet in obscure works of, quote, scientification, in little interplanetary societies and rocketry clubs, and between the covers of monstrous magazines ignored or mocked by intellectuals, but ready, if the power is ever put into its hands, to open a new chapter of misery for the universe. It is the idea that humanity, having now sufficiently corrupted the planet where it arose, must at all costs contrive to seed it over a larger area, that the vast astronomical distances, which are God's quarantine regulations, must somehow be overcome. The third book, the longer one, That Hideous Strength, in it, Lewis's horror of the forcibly planned society appears first as the institute is introduced, the nice. The nice is said to be, quote, the first fruits of that constructive fusion between the state and the laboratory on which so many people based their hopes of a better world. The bursar, Busby, a member of the progressive element, which controls Bracton College, the third novel, That Hideous Strength, is set in a college in a small university town. Busby expresses the popular notion of the purpose of the nice, which is as follows. It's the first attempt to take applied science seriously from the national point of view. And according to Lord Feverstone, one of the principals in the nice and in the college, the aims of the nice include the following. Quote, sterilization of the unfit, liquidation of backward races. We don't want any dead weights, Feverstone says. Selective breeding. And then Feverstone goes on to say, then real education, including prenatal education. By real education, I mean one that has no take-it-or-leave-it nonsense. A real education makes the patient what it wants, infallibly, whatever he or his parents try to do about it. Of course, it'll have to be mainly psychological at first, but we'll get on to biochemical conditioning at the end and direct manipulation of the brain. So, Fay Kroll is certainly right. Lewis was certain that a union of applied science and social planning with the power of government would result in the loss of freedom and individuality. Lord Feverstone, actually, in That Hideous Strength, is the same Dick Devine, who previously appeared simply as a money-hungry soul in the previous novels. He's developed a more philosophical view of life by the time we get to That Hideous Strength, but it's an interesting view. It's given here. Feverstone says, it does really look as if we now had the power to dig ourselves in as a species for a pretty staggering period, to take control of our own destiny. If science is really given a free hand, it can now take over the human race and recondition it, make man a really efficient animal. Man has got to take charge of man. That means, remember, that some men have got to take charge of the rest, and you can imagine who's going to be doing the taking charge in a quotation like this. The evil forces of in That Hideous Strength are centered in this, as I said, National Institute for Coordinated Experiments, the NICE, with a biologist and a psychologist as important but evil characters. Some readers have regarded the book as an all-out attack on science. In his unpublished, that is, unpublished in Lewis's own lifetime, in Lewis's reply to an article by Professor J.B.S. Haldane, Lewis answers this criticism by explaining just what it was that he was attacking. He says, first, a certain view about values. And these are the words of C.S. Lewis now in his response to Haldane. I'll say more about Haldane in just a minute. First, a certain view about values. The attack will be found undisguised in the abolition of man. We'll talk about that a little bit more. These are the dangers Lewis saw in the 20th century abandonment of traditional objective values. His second aim in That Hideous Strength was to illustrate the folly of devoting one's life to gaining the power and prestige of belonging to a ruling clique. And the third, Lewis continued, he was attacking not scientific planning, as Professor Haldane had thought, but the kind of planned society which first Hitler and then the European communists had instituted, what Lewis called, quote, the disciplined cruelty of some ideological oligarchy. Now, J.B.S. Haldane is someone we need to talk about a little bit because he actually is somebody that C.S. Lewis disagreed with on a number of issues. So let's talk about him for a while. This is just a little bit of, just a tiny mini-sketch of him. Haldane, born in 1892, died in 1964, was a well-known scientist, became a reader at Cambridge University in 1923, and became professor at University College London in 1933. He moved to India, interestingly, to join a research group in 1957. He became an Indian citizen in 1961 and died in India. He was an outspoken atheist and Marxist. He was the co-author of the well-known Haldane-Operin mechanism for the origin of life. Of course, those of you who are chemists and biochemists would know that this idea has been largely repudiated since then, but nevertheless, in its own time, a famous theory. C.S. Lewis reflected some of what he perceived as the qualities of Haldane in the character of Professor Weston. So Professor Weston is a bit of a caricature of J.B.S. Haldane. Particularly relevant to Lewis's space trilogy is the last chapter of a book of essays that Haldane published in 1927 entitled Possible Worlds. There, Haldane states that if the human race were to continue to survive and progress, mankind would have to colonize the planets. An interesting little snippet here is that on November 15th, 1948, Haldane spoke in Lewis's presence at the Oxford Socratic Club on the topic atheism. And he took one question, answered it very quickly, and removed himself from the auditorium. Of course, the whole purpose of the Socratic Club was to have a back and forth discussion, which Haldane apparently was not enthused about. In this response to Haldane, Lewis wrote this. He says, "If any of my romances should be plausibly accused of being a libel on scientists, it would be Out of the Silent Planet. It certainly is an attack, if not on scientists, yet on something which might be called scientism, a certain outlook on the world which is usually connected with the popularization of the sciences, although it is much less common among real scientists than among their readers. It is, in a word, the belief that the supreme moral end is the perpetuation of our own species, and this is to be pursued even if, in the process of being fitted for survival, our species has to be stripped of all those things which we value in it: pity, happiness, and freedom." One of the most revealing characters in that hideous strength is the biologist Philostrato. Philostrato would prefer artificial trees to real trees, artificial trees made of aluminum, and he'd prefer them to be populated by artificial birds that would sing at the touch of a switch, thus eliminating undesirable characteristics such as feathers, eggs, dirt, and decay. Philostrato tells Mark Studdick what he sees as the true purpose of the nice. Quote, "It is for the conquest of death or for the conquest of organic life, if you prefer. They are the same thing. It is to bring out of that cocoon of organic life which sheltered the babyhood of mind the new man, the man who will not die, the artificial man free from nature. Nature is the ladder we have climbed up by. Now we kick her away." The fact that Lewis is not negative about science per se, I think, is seen in his treatment of sociology in That Hideous Strength, when one of the characters, kind of a transition character, a very important character in the book, but one who's somewhat flexible, Mark Studdick, when he uses the phrase "sciences like sociology" in a conversation with Bracton College's most distinguished scientist, William Hingist. Bless his heart, he's a chemist. Hingist is a chemist, so we give him high marks here. So when Studdick talks about sciences like sociology, Hingist, the chemist, interrupts him and says, "There are no sciences like sociology." Mark Studdick goes on to speak of studying the reality of the common man, and Hengist interrupts again, even more abruptly, commenting on what happens when men study men. And this is what Hengist says, this hero chemist. Then I should want to pull them to pieces and put someone else in their place. That's what happens when you study men. You study mare's nests. I happen to believe that you can't study men. You can only get to know them, which is quite a different thing. So the hero chemist, aren't we glad to have him here? In an essay called The Discarded Image, Lewis expands on this, Discarded Image published after Lewis's death. In our age, the ease with which a scientific theory assumes the dignity and rigidity of fact varies inversely with the individual's scientific education. Interesting thought. The mass media, which have in our time created a popular scientism, a caricature of the true sciences. So I think we can see a difference coming out between what he thinks of science and what he thinks of scientism. His views of the two are pretty clearly quite different. Although the space trilogy was completed in 1945, C.S. Lewis did not alter the concerns expressed therein. During the year of his death, 1963, and many of you would know that he died on the same date as both John F. Kennedy and Aldous Huxley. In the year of his death, Lewis wrote this, later published in a book called Christian Reflections. Lewis wrote this: If we encounter in the depths of space a race, however innocent and amiable, which is technologically weaker than ourselves, we shall enslave, deceive, exploit, or exterminate. At the very least, we shall corrupt it with our vices and infect it with our diseases. We are not fit yet to visit other worlds. Must we go to infect other realms? So the views he expressed in the space trilogy in this regard certainly stayed with him to the end. And in The Abolition of Man, he says this, his essay, The Abolition of Man, he says this: nothing I can say will prevent some people from describing this lecture as an attack on science. I deny the charge, of course. And real natural philosophers, there are now some alive, he says, will perceive that in defending value, I defend inter alia the value of knowledge. We must put in something from the Screwtape Letters, certainly his most humorous writings. Screwtape, an experienced demon giving advice to Wormwood, a less experienced, a novice demon, just learning how to be a demon. Screwtape, the experienced demon in Screwtape Letters, makes a comment about science, which I want to bring up. He advises his nephew, Wormwood, the novice, not to attempt to use science on a patient. Now, a patient of Wormwood is someone who, a patient is someone who needs help, of course, and the sense in which such patients need help in the Screwtape Letters is these are persons considering Christianity. So from the point of view of Screwtape and Wormwood, these people need help. So he's saying, don't use science. And then he says in parentheses, I mean the real sciences. Don't use science, I mean the real sciences, as a defense against Christianity. They will positively encourage him to think about realities he can't touch and see. There have been sad cases among the modern physicists. If he must dabble in science, let him keep on economics and sociology. But the best of all is to let him read no science at all, but to give him a grand general idea that he knows it all and that everything he happens to have picked up in casual talk and reading is, quote, the results of modern investigation. Lewis was concerned about the modern rejection of absolute standards and objective values. He thought this would leave mankind with no defense against what some persons might do with the powers of science. His love of individual freedom, and his appreciation for people as creatures of worth in God's sight caused him to fear what might be done to humanity if science, without the objective values to restrain it, were to be given the power of government to enforce what a few persons might plan for all the rest. Lewis reminded his readers that naturalism, determinism, and empiricism all view man as a biological accident with no meaning and no unmeasurable quantities like soul or spirit. They presuppose that there's no God or absolute truth or values. The study of humankind by sociologists, psychologists, and anthropologists, according to Lewis, has reduced persons to having little dignity or worth, having little or no individual responsibility for their choices and actions. In explaining nature and man, scientists have explained away his value and meaning. End of part one. Okay, this is my analysis of what C.S. Lewis thought about science and scientism. And the rest of the lecture is to try to bring this up to date. So question number one, well, this is question number two out of three, is, and I hope I've used about a half hour because that's what I scheduled for what we've done so far, is scientism alive and well in 1997? The answer to that question is, it's an easy question. The answer is yes. And let's begin with the most famous statement of scientism of this century, given by Carl Sagan in his Cosmos television program, "The cosmos is all there is, or ever was, or ever will be." Now, let me be very clear that in some respects, I'm an admirer of Carl Sagan's. I mean, he has done a wonderful job as a popularizer of science, and his movie series does give a nice view of the wonder of science. So there are lots of, I mean, I could talk in positive terms about him in many ways, but Sagan comes with this overlayer of metaphysical naturalism or some sort of philosophical worldview that is sometimes fairly oppressive. And it is the view not of science, but of scientism. A statement like this is not a statement of science at all. It's a statement of belief. All right. Less known than Carl Sagan is an individual named Daniel Dennett. Daniel Dennett is a philosopher slash sociologist at Tufts University, and his book called Darwin's Dangerous Idea is a model reductionist work, or it's a model work of scientism, and precisely the sort of scientism that so concerned C.S. Lewis. If C.S. Lewis were with us today, Daniel Dennett would certainly be someone he would have something to say about, because this book, Daniel Dennett, written by this sociologist, is a book about science, and that is exactly the sort of author that C.S. Lewis did not like to talk about these things. And so let's see what Dennett has. Let's give Dennett a chance to speak for himself. This is an interesting little snippet toward the end of his book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea. He says, "My own spirit recoils from a personal God in the same way my heart sinks when I see a lion pacing neurotically back and forth in a small zoo cage. I know the lion is beautiful but dangerous. If you let the lion roam free, it would kill me. Safety demands that it be put in a cage. Safety demands that religions be put in cages too." And then he gives us an example. This, "We can't just have the second-class status of women in Roman Catholicism." So all of science is leading to a conclusion that the Pope should be put in jail. This is most definitely the sort of logic that C.S. Lewis would not be comfortable with. A sociologist writing about science making conclusions about religion. Even in my own field of quantum chemistry, one occasionally can capture little nuggets of scientism. And here is one that was published some years ago, which attracted my attention. It may be a bit hard for you to read from the back there, so I'll be careful. This is by Andrew McLaughlin, published in International Journal of Quantum Chemistry 20 years ago. Living systems are wonderfully well suited to their purpose, but the design is shaped by blind evolution instead of imaginative intelligence. This is not a statement of science. It is a statement of scientism. Richard Dawkins, author of the famous book, The Blind Watchmaker, is the very model of a modern materialist reductionist. For example, Dawkins describes love as, quote, a product of highly complicated nervous equipment or computing equipment of some sort. And in fact, although I understand that Dawkins is now happily married, in the past, there was some feeling that that Dawkins was attempting to test as much of this computing machinery as he possibly could. When asked if such a worldview is depressing, Dawkins responds, quote, I don't feel depressed about it. Steven Weinberg, a kinder, gentler sort of a reductionist, has written a book which I like very much called Dreams of a Final Theory. Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize winner in physics, vintage about 1978. In the middle of this book, Dreams of a Final Theory, is a wonderful chapter called What About God? Without question, this is the most insightful essay I have ever seen written about God by an atheist. I mean, it's really wonderful. You need to borrow this book from somebody and read this chapter, What About God? And right in the middle of this chapter, this atheist, Steven Weinberg, quotes in length a poem by the Venerable Bede. Now, only scholars of the humanities here will know who the Venerable Bede was, but he was a medieval churchman. He died in the year 735 A.D., a long time ago. And he was sort of a Renaissance man for 700 A.D., you know, as far as Renaissance men were around back then. Weinberg quotes this poem and then says, it's almost irresistible. It is an almost irresistible temptation to believe with Bede that there must be something for us outside the banqueting hall. And in the poem, the banqueting hall is reductionism in modern parlance. So Weinberg is saying it's almost an irresistible temptation to believe that there must be something for us beyond reductionism. But ultimately he does resist. Now, Weinberg does. But really, the very same notion that Weinberg is expressing is expressed in Romans chapter 1, where we read that ever since the creation of the world, God's eternal power and divine nature, invisible though they are, have been understood and seen through the things he has made. This is really the same statement. It really is. These are the same statement. So even reductionists are sometimes concerned about reductionism. Another example of a person who's... Arno Penzias is not a reductionist, let me be very clear. Arno Penzias, winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics 1978, is a theist. Let me be clear about that. Got the Nobel Prize for observation of the microwave background radiation, which more than anything else established the Big Bang theory of the origin of the universe. And when he was asked, just a year ago, when Arno Penzias was asked why some cosmologists were so affectionate in their embrace of the steady-state theory of the universe, a steady-state theory, the idea that what you see in terms of the universe is what there always was, Why were some people so affectionate in this, in their embrace of the steady state theory? Penzias responds this way, namely, that it's the blindness of reductionism. He says, well, some people are uncomfortable with the purposefully created world. To come up with things that contradict purpose, they tend to speculate about things they haven't seen. All right. Now, I had great thoughts of doing a lot on Stephen Hawking tonight, but that's, I can see that I have underestimated the amount of time it would take to get me through this. So let me just touch on him briefly. Hawking, of course, author of the book, which has sold 20 million copies, A Brief History of Time. But just a little bit at that. Hawking is certainly a kinder, gentler sort of reduction, even kinder and gentler than Steven Weinberg, I might add. Although no one knows what it means, Stephen Hawking has actually been attending an Anglican church in Cambridge once or twice a month for the last 2 years. What that means, I'm not sure. Nobody in Cambridge I've talked to is sure either. But the most famous statement in his book is, I think, the closing statement. He says, however, if we do discover a complete theory, then we would know the mind of God. Well, you know, I'd love to have a complete understanding of the relationship between gravity and quantum mechanics, which is what the book is about. And it would certainly tell us something more about the mind of God. But to say that that is the mind of God, full stop, I think is getting carried away a bit. I'm going to have to skip all these wonderful things that I... for those that stay for the questions, I will be glad to do that. But let me do a little more on reductionism first. And you see statements like this from Freeman Dyson, Princeton physicist. This is the kind of statement that reductionists are really forced to if they're honest. This is expressing an honesty, although a somewhat naive honesty, I would have to say. Freeman Dyson says, nature has been kinder to us than we had any right to expect. This really raises more questions than it answers. And the question this raises is, on what basis would we decide how kind nature ought to be to us? Martin Rees, a contemporary of Hawking, says something similar. The possibility of life as we know it depends on the values of a few basic physical constants and is, in some respects, remarkably sensitive to their numerical values. Nature does exhibit some remarkable coincidences. And my comment on these two gentlemen would be the following, that these people express surprise at so many accidental occurrences. However, the astonishment quickly disappears if one sees intelligent design instead of arbitrariness in the laws of nature. I can't give a talk like this without quoting something by Richard Feynman. Richard Feynman, also a reductionist, but one who in his later years began to have some doubts. And here is the best example of those doubts. So we could call this the doubts of a reductionist. Feynman, everything in physical science is a lot of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And let me say parenthetically that don't we love them? I mean, this is good stuff, protons, neutrons, and electrons. We love this stuff. You know, this is red meat for us. While in daily life, Feynman continues, we talk about men in history or beauty and hope. Which end is nearer to God? Beauty and hope are the fundamental laws. To stand at either end and to walk off that end of the pier only, hoping that out in that direction is the complete understanding, is a mistake. So this could be called the reservations of a reductionist. Are some persons concerned about scientism? about scientism, about the, today, about the same sorts of things that that Lewis was. Well, I think they are. Here is a just a little bit. Actually, I'm starting to skip things now. Just a little bit. You know, when I began this lecture, when Terry gave me this title, I said, how am I going to get 60 minutes out of this, Terry? And as I've been working on it for the last month, the question has been, how am I going to get this down to 60 minutes? But this is a an essay. Actually, this was in the Wall Street Journal, of all places. This is an invited editorial that Phil Johnson wrote for the Wall Street Journal on reductionism. Remarkable place to read about reductionism, but it's one of the best things that's been written. And he says, naturalistic metaphysics relegates questions like how we should live or what we should value to the realm of subjective opinion. It provides no sacred common ground other than a supposedly value-free science to unite differing human groups and to give them a foundation to reason from. Is it any wonder that the great universities that are permeated by this philosophy, scientism, are themselves being torn apart by groups that demand separate academic departments to promote their ideologies? Well, some concluding remarks on reductionism that are now going to be rather pointed. Reductionists will try to explain away all non-scientific aspects of human experience. From the consistent reductionist perspective, Beethoven's music really is just vibrations in the air. The Mona Lisa really is just a collection of specks of paint of known composition. It is hard to exaggerate the implausibility of this limited view of reality. All that is most profound and all that makes human life worth living is devalued and discarded, sacrificed to an unjustified scientific imperialism. And this statement by me, a person who loves science very much, in fact is passionate about science. I cannot accept that my conviction that torturing children is wrong is just a conventional agreement of our society to see things this way. I know as surely as I accept Coulomb's law that love is better than hate and that truth is better than the lie. Section number 3. Do nearly all scientists believe in scientism? Do nearly all scientists believe in scientism? The answer to that question is no. But I should back that up a bit. Alan Lightman, an MIT professor, has written a fascinating book called Origins, The Lives and Worlds of Modern Cosmologists. He took the modern investigative reporter approach. He published this book with Harvard University Press in 1990. He took his tape recorder around the world, around the country, around the world, and asked famous cosmologists what they thought about ultimate issues. Things like, what is life? Does God exist? And so on and so forth. And this is the way he describes it, summarizing the whole position of scientists with respect to God. He says, references to God or divine purpose continued in the scientific literature until the middle to late 1800s. It seems likely that the lack of religious references after this time resulted more from a change in social and professional convention among scientists rather than from any change in underlying thought. And now his bottom line. Indeed, contrary to popular myth, scientists appear to have the same range of attitudes about religious matters as does the general public. And a statement, an anti-reductionist statement, a statement against scientism by Erwin Schrödinger, the discoverer, developer, however you want to describe this, of the most important equation in in science, Schrodinger's equation says this, and this is a very sobering statement. Schrodinger says, I'm very astonished that the scientific picture of the world around me is very deficient. It gives a lot of factual information, puts all our experience in a magnificently consistent order, but it is ghastly silent about all and sundry that is really near to our heart, that really matters to us. And skipping to the bottom here, whoops, can't skip quite that fast. Science sometimes pretends to answer questions in these domains, the questions of ultimate questions, but the answers are very often so silly that we're not inclined to take them seriously. Perhaps one of the most trenchant statements I have seen against scientism, Erwin Schrodinger. Let me make the question a bit closer to the heart of C.S. Lewis, I hope, and ask, is it possible to be a scientist and a Christian? Are most scientists believers in scientism? No. Let's be more specific. Is it possible to be a scientist and a Christian? Well, the answer to that question is also yes. And here is a laundry list of famous scientists, Christians. The ones on the left-hand side are no longer living. I suppose we could call them dead white males. Yes, that's what they are. But this list of dead white males is most of the great heroes of science. I mean, look at this list. Francis Bacon, Johannes Kepler, Blaise Pascal, Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, Michael Faraday, James Maxwell, William Henry Perkin, George Stokes, Lord Kelvin, J.J. Thomson, and so on. The ones on the right-hand side, let me tell you a little bit about some of those. I certainly don't want to be accused of only talking about dead white males. That would be a terrible thing. Before I do that, let me give you a challenging statement, which will certainly make some uncomfortable, by the British academic Robert Clark in his book called Christian Belief and Science, but he really is the most direct about this of anybody I've seen. He says, however we may interpret the fact, scientific development has only occurred in a Christian culture. For my own satisfaction, I would have to modify that statement with the addition of one word, sustained. So I would say, to make this defensible, I would say, however we may interpret the fact, sustained scientific development has only occurred in a Christian culture. And Clark goes on to say, the ancients had brains as good as ours in all civilizations. Science developed to a certain point and then stopped. It is easy to argue speculatively that perhaps science might have been able to develop in the absence of Christianity, but in fact it never did, and so on. All right? I can't resist one. Please let me use one dead white male. That dead white male is the greatest experimental scientist to date. Michael Faraday, my friend John Thomas, who is now Sir John Thomas. I had to inform John when we spent a week together in Australia a year and a half ago that it was difficult for me to call him Sir. And he said, well, in your case, since we knew each other before I became Sir, I think I'll probably let you off. Very, very gracious remark on John's part. John was the director of the Royal Institution, Michael Faraday's scientific home for all of his career, and on the 200th anniversary of Faraday's birth, John Thomas wrote an interesting paper in Chemistry in Britain, in which he said that if Michael Faraday had lived to the age of the Nobel Prize, he would have certainly received no less than 7 Nobel Prizes, which is be pretty nice, and it's not far from the truth. Not far from the truth. Let me, it's just a little bit on Michael Faraday, but let me tell you this story, which is a true story. This is a story about the end of Faraday's life. Faraday had come to the end of his distinguished scientific career, and a well-wisher came to see him in the hospital. Someone said to him on his deathbed, "Sir Michael, what speculations do you have now?" And, you know, being around people who are dying is not a happy way to spend a Saturday afternoon. And obviously this well-wisher is trying to lighten the conversation, because Faraday's whole scientific career was one of speculation. He would make a speculation, go into the laboratory, and either prove it or disprove it. So, you know, a very friendly comment in that vein. And I wish I'd been there for this conversation, because Faraday looked this person right in the eye and said, "Speculations, man, I have none. I have certainties. I thank God I don't rest my dying head upon speculation, for I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that he is able to keep that which I have committed unto him against that day." Remarkable statement. My candidate for scientist of this century would be Charlie Townes, Berkeley professor. I admit to some bias here. The only candidate for scientist of the century that I know personally is Charlie Townes. So yes, there may be some personal interest here. But Charlie did do something important. He discovered the laser. Give credit where credit is due. Charlie almost got a second Nobel Prize in physics for his discovery of the first interstellar molecule, a discovery closer to my own personal research. My candidate for the great... And Charlie has gotten on this bandwagon of writing books. His book is called Making Waves. That's a play on words, because lasers are waves of a sort. And here is what Charlie has to say about the origins question. Charlie says, "In my view, the question of origin seems always left unanswered if we explore from a scientific view alone." In other words, Charlie Townes is saying, scientism is not everything. "Thus, I believe there is a need for some religious or metaphysical explanation. I believe in the concept of God and in his existence." And in his existence. John Polkinghorne, professor of mathematical physics at Cambridge University for a number of years, currently president of Queen's College in Cambridge, says this. Is it possible to be a Christian? He says, "I take God very seriously indeed. I am a Christian believer and believe that God exists and has made himself known in human terms in Jesus Christ." Arthur Schawlow, Nobel Prize winner in physics, 1981, identifies himself as a Protestant Christian. I'm not trying to draw the circle that tightly. That's not my intention here at all. I'm just telling you what he said. But Arthur Schawlow makes this statement. He says, "We are fortunate to have the Bible, and especially the New Testament, which tells us so much about God in widely accessible human terms. The greatest living observational cosmologist is a man named Alan Sandage. There is no Nobel Prize for cosmology per se, but every sixth year, the Swedish Royal Academy gives something called the Crawford Prize in cosmology, and it's worth $1 million, so it's okay to get it. Alan Sandage got the last one in 1991. Another one will be given October of this year. The New York Times calls him the grand old man of cosmology. I don't think Alan thinks himself that old, but nevertheless, here's a statement by Alan Sandage. "The nature of God is not to be found within any part of the findings of science." In other words, scientism isn't enough. "For that, one must turn to the scriptures." And he is asked the age-old question, can a person be a scientist and also a Christian? And he answers yes. Sandage, of course, is a Christian. But the way he answers this question is interesting, because here he is, the greatest living observational cosmologist in the world, and when he's asked to defend himself, he turns to biology. Look at this. He says, "The world is too complicated in all its parts and interconnections to be due to chance alone. I'm convinced that the existence of life, with all its order in each of its organisms, is simply too well put together. In other words, biology forces us to a belief in God. Certainly one of Stephen Hawking's most famous students is Donald Page, now professor of physics at the University of Alberta. Page continues to have a very rich, independent scientific career. Those of you that read the Physical Review Letters, the most prestigious journal in physics, will know that he continues to publish regularly there. And here is Donald Page's statement. He says, "I'm a conservative Christian in the sense of pretty much taking the Bible seriously for what it says. Of course, I know that certain parts are not intended to be read literally, so I'm not precisely a literalist. When we read in the book of Psalms that God shelters his children under his wings, it does not mean that God is a big chicken. The clear intention of the author is something else, to describe the nurturing characteristics of God." So I think Page is making a good point here. It says, "But I try to believe in the meaning I think it is intended to have." All right, conclusions. Conclusions. We're just about done now. Conclusions. Three questions, worded a little bit differently. Number one, is C.S. Lewis's critique of scientism valid today? I would say, in the broad sense, yes. There may be somewhat less enthusiasm among intellectuals today for proliferating human sinfulness to other planets than was the case in 1938. However, the continuing popularity of Star Wars and Star Trek, not to mention the tragic demise of the Heaven's Gate cult, are sobering in this regard. Question number two, is scientism alive and well today? Yes. There can be little doubt that C.S. Lewis would have been as skeptical of the modern reductionist Richard Dawkins today as he was of J.B.S. Haldane in 1938. Further, Lewis almost certainly would have had reservations about state-supported research on frozen human embryos. Lewis would not have been supportive of the use of human genome research to terminate the lives of fetuses that were less than genetically perfect. Third and last, do most scientists believe in scientism today? Not according to a poll of some 3,000 members of the Scientific Honorary Society, Sigma Xi, and I will quote directly from Chemical and Engineering News, in which they say, scientists from the poll, this is the result of the poll, scientists are anchored in the U.S. mainstream, half participate in religious activities regularly. Moreover, as I have documented, many distinguished contemporary scientists have found the truth claims of Jesus Christ to be intellectually compelling. My challenge to those of you who are not familiar with C.S. Lewis's writings is to read Mere Christianity and consider the claims of Jesus. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Schaefer. We're now going to have a time of questions, but before that, I want to inform you that we're going to be passing out a response card, and I believe the other members of the committee are going to be handing those out now. And we just ask that you spend a minute and fill out those cards so that we can inform you about next year's lecture, for example, and also so that you can give us some response as to this lecture. But while we're doing that, we would welcome your questions. And if you'll just stand up with a question and speak loudly, I will then repeat the question and then give Dr. Schaefer time to answer. Are there questions? Yes.
What do you think about the recent mapping of the brain that seems to be progressing among neurobiologists and neurochemists? The research that does seem to at times be able to locate a place in the brain attached to certain personality characteristics, those higher values like love and pity and compassion, are the neurobiologists, are they encroaching on our ability to see something more than pure physical events in these values?
The question is, what does Dr. Schaefer think about the recent mapping of the brain by neurobiologists and how that affects, that finds values in the chemistry of the brain?
What do I think about it? I think it's interesting. I certainly am happy to see that sort of research supported and don't feel like it's threatening to any theist. Certainly, there are going to be relationships between human behavior and brain function. I think this is not a profound revelation in itself. The details, many of the details will undoubtedly be elucidated. What reductionists would like us to believe, what those who believe in scientism would like to have others believe, is the idea that neurons firing in the brain are responsible in a causal deterministic way for everything that took place here this evening. So I say with research of that sort, I certainly welcome it and think that it can be quite helpful.
Yes. The question is, has Dr. Schaefer discussed any of these matters with his protagonists?
You're going to have to define my protagonist before I can answer that question. I have certainly not met Richard Dawkins. I wouldn't call him I wouldn't refer to any of these people as my protagonists. I certainly don't harbor any ill will toward any of these people. I haven't met Richard Dawkins. Have I discussed these things? I made up this lecture in the last 2 weeks. No, I have not had a chance to. I'm just barely getting these ideas formulated, far less being able to discuss them with anybody yet. But perhaps I'll give this talk in some other places, and we will be able to have a dialogue. I think that would be wonderful. I would certainly be excited about it. Yeah, I hope that's part of my future.